This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted to have Leonard Schlain with us. When we talked, you said misogyny, the fear and hatred men have toward women. You talked about that and made some very compelling arguments in The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. I had the opportunity some while back to hear the man who led the Human Genome Project say that, in fact, serendipity best comes to the prepared mind.
Right.
Now, I like that a lot.
Right.
You've been thinking about all of these things
right.
a long time, and you bring such a wide variety of ideas to the fore. Is this the crystal for which you've been looking?
Well, I as many colleague and nurse in the operating room have told me, boy, you're weird. You know, I always have had a very eclectic reading habits and explored a lot of different sources of information. And as I've grown older, it just seems like all of these pieces of disparate parts of the puzzle come together to create patterns that seem to me logical, rational explanations for things that are very difficult to explain. I think that misogyny, you know, some people would say, well, misogyny, Freud believed it was a function of the fact that men had to reject their mothers in order to become men. And other, you know, a lot of feminists believe that it's a cultural thing, that if only we dress little boys in pink and little girls in blue, that we could begin to ameliorate this problem. But I think that there's something inherent in male-female relations and that has to do with the fact that misogyny doesn't really start until puberty. And then, you know, when you listen to the conversations of young men, I mean, that's when they're the most misogynist. As the men get older, they get a little softer. But I think that the men suffer from a feeling of frustration and anger over the hoops that they have to jump through to get a woman to say yes to sex. I mean, it's either they have to marry them or they've got to do a lot of things. And the men don't understand that they're playing a game. To them, it's a game. See how many times they can score. But once the woman understood the enormous implications of getting pregnant for a human compared to any other animal, she said, I'm not going to engage in this practice unless I get some assurances that you're going to help me stick around when this baby's born. So the agendas of men and women are so extraordinarily different that you can't help but have a certain degree of conflict. Now, fortunately, each human is a psychic hermaphrodite. And meaning that every man has a masculine side and a feminine side, and every woman has a masculine side and a feminine side. You know, you don't usually associate warm, fuzzy, and affectionate with the word stags, bulls, and boars. I mean, you know, those animals don't have much of a feminine side. And humans have this extraordinary mixture of masculine and feminine, anima and animus, because in order for a man and a woman to come together and love each other and care for each other enough to be able to stay and raise a child to the point where that child reaches the level of maturity that it too can raise its own children, and we can pass on our genes, is an extraordinary development, evolutionarily speaking. So men and women need to be able to relate to each other. They need to mesh with each other. A woman is always looking to see whether a man has a soft side. And a man, you know, will usually seek out a woman who complements that part of him that's missing. So you get some big macho guy who's got a very poorly developed feminine side, usually marries some incredibly feminine woman who has a very poor masculine side. They kind of, you know, and you have all different combinations of these things. So there is this unique thing that humans can love each other more intensely for longer periods of time than just about any other animal. And that has to do with this enormous responsibility of childbearing. At the same time, you have these two sexual agendas. You know, in a month's time, a woman produces one egg. That's it. During that same period of time, a man masturbating frequently can generate enough sperm to impregnate every single living woman on the face of this planet in a month's time. Now, that's pretty profligate. I mean, if the ratio was 1,000 to 1, it would be pretty impressive. But the fact that it's 360 billion to one makes for it makes for mischief. I mean, I'm always reminded of Nietzsche's quote where he said, "God is a comedian who's playing before an audience who's too frightened to laugh." You know, I mean, when you think of the incredible mistiming of woman's orgasm compared to men's orgasm, and the fact that men are at the peak of their sexual libido when they're teenagers, and women don't achieve that until they're in their late 30s, you have to look to yourself, who set this up? I mean, this is a, I mean, I sort of figure that maybe we'll all get together in the nursing home.
Well, you know. You regularly, in the course of Sex, Time, and Power, go back and say, "I don't mean it literally when I say who or that this
right,
person."
Exactly.
And
yeah,
it's important to always go back and say this happened over millennia. This wasn't a person deciding to do a thing.
Well, let me make clear on that point. I believe that natural selection is a natural process, that you don't need to have a intelligent designer to have brought about this whole process. I anthropomorphize Mother Nature in the book for as a poetic license literary device, but I want to make it clear that each listener has to decide whether or not this incredible process of natural selection, environmental changes acting upon the genome of an organism to cause it to either change or adapt, whether or not that was set in motion by an intelligent designer is something each person has to decide for themselves. But Darwin's theories have been around for 150 years now, and they've provided scientists with an incredibly predictive tool, and it's not necessary to interject the notion that somebody designed the earwig's wing.
That said, you do also join a number of scientists who say that there is a woman who had a set of physical mutations. This is physical.
Right.
That then caused these other things to
happen. I mean, African Eve, they've actually pinpointed it to the point that she gave birth to her child 143,000 years ago.
This is somebody who, what happened?
Yeah, well, there must have been some isolated group of Homo erectus that were under some environmental stress that was causing them to either go extinct or adapt. Now, everyone's been looking for what that environmental stress was, and most people think it was something in the food supply or some new predator. I maintain that they're looking in the wrong place. It was an internal change. It was the narrowness of the pelvis and the extraordinary size of the baby's brain that provided a environmental stress that was killing the women from an internal side. And it was only the women who were dying, not the men, because they didn't birth big brain babies and die in childbirth. So I think that the environmental stress was, it's called the obstetrical dilemma, and that you know, it's been estimated that the human female should be 18 months pregnant, according to the gestational periods of other primates. But the human female cannot be pregnant for more than 9 months, because a week beyond 9 months, that baby's brain is growing so rapidly that the baby will kill her and itself if you don't get it out of there in 9 months. So our babies are born alitricial, meaning that they're so immature that they're deposited into this world long before their time, which then creates this enormous burden on women that they give birth to the most helpless babies that require the most care, which then sets up the situation where we have this extraordinary split in the specialization of power between the male and the female. There's no other species that has a division of labor so extreme as it is in humans. I mean, if you had a zoo that had humans in it and you were some intergalactic visitor and you were looking at all the cages, you know, it's hard to tell the male from the female in other species, except when they're breeding. If you just took away the external signs, in terms of their behavior, pretty much the same what males and females do, until you got to the cage with the humans. And it would be very, very different between the behavior modes of what the female does and what the male does. I'm talking about very early humans. So there were a series of things that were set in motion by our standing up and developing this big brain that set in motion a series of adaptations that made us distinctly human.
One of the things, listening to you, and it really comes, it seems to come out more than reading, part of, a lot of this seems to be mechanisms for making human society much, much, much richer. The language piece, the size of the brain, the relationships across very strange, you know, the male and female, the old and the young, and the incredible differences, the care requirements between mother and child, and then as the responsibilities. All of this appears to make the social environment much richer than it would otherwise possibly be, you know, which is not precisely your message, but it seems to be almost a byproduct, an inevitable
Absolutely.
Byproduct
right, but
of what you're describing.
Right, but the problem that we have as a species, which is a difficult one that we have to overcome, is that every major predator on this planet was operational by 60 million years ago. Wolves, lions, eagles, sharks much longer, alligators much longer. And we're primates. And primates are prey animals. They run like hell from danger. How is it possible that a little puny biped about 5 feet tall with no claws, no canines, no great strength and no great speed, in the space of less than a million years, compared to 60 million years, became the most dangerous predator on this planet? And it's the human male. And in order to accomplish that, not only did you have to give him a big brain and a very clever weapon in his free hand, that wouldn't have been enough. You had to infuse him with a aggressiveness and courage and sadisticness and cold-bloodedness that makes him the killer that he is. But we overshot the mark. We now have a male who is so sadistic and vicious and such a killer that he's killing his own species. He's killing all the animals on the planet. He's killing the very environment that gives him sustenance. So I know that that sounds fairly pessimistic, but I'm actually very optimistic, and I end the book with the notion that we are transforming into another species.
Which we will
speak.
Which we will do when we come back in just a moment with Leonard Schlein. Do be with us for the pièce de résistance on the Paula Gordon Show.